Hi there, it's Marco. Because you listen to The World, you know that we've been closely following the war in Ukraine for months, even as it was just beginning to develop. Correspondents Daniel Offman and Duri Buscarin brought you stories from the ground in Ukraine and Romania as the conflict escalated. We've been able to call on experts like Bill Browder to discuss the impact of sanctions against Russia. And you've heard from the people at the center of these events, like Oksana Kolesnik, who fled Chernihiv with her daughter and is now the director of the new Warsaw Ukrainian School in Poland. The World's reporting has helped you better understand the war in Ukraine. This kind of nuanced, human-centered reporting is only possible because of listener support. Please consider donating now to our fundraiser before June 30th. You can make your gift and learn more at theworld.org/give or follow the link in our episode notes. Help power our newsroom today at theworld.org/give. Thanks, and now the show. The war in Ukraine continues to rage in the east. We hear from a volunteer fighter on the front lines who says he has no other option.
We fight or, we move to another country, to another planet. It's like, a gangster or burglar storms into your house, you have to defend.
Also today, Belgium's King Philippe is visiting a former African colony. He returned a Congolese mask as a token of goodwill. Some Congolese say it's critical that more artifacts are returned.
Because when the objects were taken, the people were also cut off from their cultures, cut off from their history.
I'm Marco Werman, and President Biden is easing up on solar panel tariffs aimed at China.
The president's doing this to prevent the collapse of the U.S. solar industry.
And also to get more solar panels quickly up on American roofs. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. We begin with pain at the pump. If you're a commuter listening in your car right now, you already know this. The average price of gas here in the U.S. is just 3 pennies shy of $5 a gallon. That's according to AAA. In California, drivers are paying $6.40. But let's not feel too bad for ourselves in this country. It could be much worse. The World's Sarah Birnbaum gets us going.
I went to fill up the car this morning with my husband, Brian.
Okay, here we go. Yikes. I can't believe how fast these 14, numbers 15, are going. 15, it's going like... 15, 20, 20. This is going to be like $1,000 to fill this tank.
It was $100 to fill the tank. But still, $100? You've got to be kidding me. As outrageous as that is, Ken Houston says I should consider myself lucky. He's a teacher in Donegal in the northwest of Ireland.
What is your gallon at the moment?
It's $5, yeah. Like $5 a gallon.
Yeah, well, the comparison with us is $8 per gallon.
He says people are angry about it.
I remember going to pick up some fuel one day at our gas station, and there were a lot of irate customers coming in because, I mean, the price had literally climbed 10 cents in the previous 24 to 36 hours. And that's how ridiculous it was. And like there were, very sensible people coming in and they were absolutely furious. They started pointing fingers at people and saying, you guys are price gouging. You guys are taking advantage here, you know.
Houston felt bad for the gas station attendant, but he gets it. These prices, they're enough to send anyone over the edge.
It's pretty serious, you know, not to put a dampener on things, but where we live in Ireland, it's quite remote. Like, we're not talking huge distances here, but when you start driving around in a car, it soon adds up, you know.
Oh, I do know. And so do folks in Greece, where gas is $8.70 a gallon, and in Norway, where it's $9.64. So if I were to fill up my compact SUV in Norway, it would run me $175. There's a reason prices are so high over there. Taxes. Fuel taxes in Europe can top $3 a gallon. Another reason is supply.
We have oil. The United States is blessed with the ability to drill its own oil. And so many other countries are dependent upon other nations.
That's Giacomo Santangelo, an economist at Fordham University.
One of the difficulties that a lot of countries are having is in getting oil transported to them. With rising oil prices, the cost to actually transport the oil is even going up since the ships that transport the oil use gas. So it's only exacerbating the problem. And then Russia invaded Ukraine.
That one affects all of us. Russia is one of the biggest oil producers in the world. After it invaded Ukraine, traders, shippers, and financiers backed away from Russian oil, removing a lot of it from the daily global supply. Econ 101, supply goes down, prices go up. And experts say it's not likely to get better anytime soon. China is easing its COVID restrictions, so it will need more gas. And over here in the U.S., it's peak driving season. So what happened to me and my husband, Brian, this morning when we saw the total amount?
That's unbelievable.
That is our new normal. Or it could get even worse.
This better last a while.
Yeah.
For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into those gas prices and the global factors making us faint at the pump. For that, we turn to Ben Cahill. He's a senior fellow with the Center for International and Strategic Studies in Washington. Help us understand the basics, Ben. There is a worldwide market and a price for oil. In Sarah's story just now, we heard that the U.S. is in better shape because we pump so much of our own oil. But if there's a global price, what is the U.S. advantage? Lower transportation costs to get oil to market or better refining capacity?
Yes, the U.S. is one of the largest oil producers in the world. We're, in fact, the largest oil and gas producer in the world. But we are still not energy independent, and we probably never will be. The reality is that gasoline prices and diesel prices in the United States reflect global market conditions.
In reaction to the Russian invasion, Europe started phasing in a ban of Russian oil last week. How much is that impacting global gas prices?
It does have an effect. In recent months, more of the oil and gas majors and commodity traders around the world have said they're going to stop doing business with Russia. They won't take Russian exports. We're looking at a tighter market. You know, even before the Russia-Ukraine war, we had a big run-up in oil prices. There wasn't a whole lot of spare capacity around the world. And heading into, you know, the second half of this year, the market looks even tighter. So there's a lot of nervousness about what happens if we actually do see a big supply disruption from Russia.
So you're saying things could get even worse?
I think they could. I mean, the big question is with the EU sanctions, how much do they drive Russian oil off the market versus just forcing Russia to redirect it elsewhere? And what Russia is trying to do is redirect all that oil to Asia, primarily India and China. And they've been successful in doing that in the last couple of months. India has stepped up as a big buyer of Russian oil, but it's not clear that they can find buyers for all of that. So it probably means some supply losses. And because this is a tight market, you know, when you drive down supply, prices tend to rise.
So Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus have pledged to increase oil production. What will that do in the short term to help?
Now I think the tone is changing a little bit. They do feel the need for more supply onto the market, and they're signaling that they're going to have to strike a new deal this fall, and we'll probably see some more output from Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But the challenge for OPEC Plus is that there's not a whole lot of spare capacity in the system. They can't really add that much more onto the market. I think that gasoline prices are so high, energy prices are so high, that it's a big political liability. And the reality is there are not that many things that you can do to cope with a big run-up in gasoline prices. But trying to add more supply onto the market in whatever way you can is typically what a president will do. And that means calling Saudi Arabia and asking for help.
A lot of analysts have pointed to Iran as a possible solution to the crisis if Iran were to agree with the U.S. on a nuclear deal. How would the reintroduction of Iranian oil help?
Iran is one of the few countries that could really ramp up production in the near term if a deal happens. Most people believe you could have 500,000 barrels a day to 1 million barrels a day within a year. And that's a lot. In a tight market, you know, having that kind of increment would be big. The problem is the talks have been going on for many months. They seem to have stalled out. And in fact, things seem to be getting worse. So the Iran question has always been the great unknown in the oil market for the last year. And we still don't know if a deal will happen.
And what about Venezuela, a country that pays some of the lowest prices in the world per gallon of gas? Still, Biden administration, I know, has been in talks with the government there. What's happening?
There have been some talks about trying to cut a deal with Venezuela so that some of the sanctions would be eased if certain political conditions were met in the country and Venezuela will be able to export more. In reality, I don't think that it's going to add that much to the market, certainly not enough to bring prices down.
It's a really, really tough situation. Are there some other steps the Biden administration could take right now to help bring down these prices of gas at the pump? Or at the end of the day, are we overstating the ability of any president to do much of anything on these prices?
I think the reality is that presidents don't control energy prices. There are very few near-term measures that they can take. The Biden administration has already made some really aggressive moves in releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And I do think it's helped. Prices would probably be even higher if the SPR reserves were not on the market. What's probably going to cool the market down is slower economic growth and demand destruction rather than a supply response.
Ben Cahill is a senior fellow with the Center for International and Strategic Studies in Washington. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
One of the blockbuster movies in India this year is about a sex worker in Bombay in the 50s and 60s. The protagonist is played by Bollywood starlet Alia Bhatt. She fights for the rights of sex workers and makes fiery speeches demanding respect for her profession. In recent years, those demands have been heard off-screen, too. Sex workers across India have been organizing and calling for their work to be recognized as work. Recently, their efforts scored a major victory. Sushmita Pathak has this report.
On a cloudy afternoon in Hyderabad in southern India, I meet a group of sex workers in a small, mostly quiet lane. They're waiting for me in a car that belongs to a local NGO. They insist on talking inside the car because they don't feel safe outside. Even though consensual sex work by adults is technically legal in India, Sunita, who goes by one name, tells me she's been arrested many times. Police, she says, are sex workers' biggest problem. They verbally abuse us, insult our family, and treat us as if we're not human, she says. India's Supreme Court wants to change that. In late May, judges ordered police to stop the abuse of sex workers and to treat them with dignity. The court also reiterated that sex work is a profession. Sex workers danced on the streets, celebrating the court order. It follows another big ruling last year when judges told the government to issue identity cards to sex workers so that they may access benefits and voting rights. Sex worker and activist Aisha Rai says her community is becoming more vocal and more visible in the mainstream.
There have been a lot of change. Lot of change.
But the law is working against them, she says. Even though voluntary sex work has been legal in India for decades, related activities like soliciting or running brothels are not. So brothel keepers become criminals. That, in effect, criminalizes sex work too, Rai says.
We are demanding full decriminalization along with the third parties because we believe that these third parties are the part of our sex work.
The ban on brothels is part of an anti-trafficking law. For a long time, advocacy around sex work was focused on rehabilitation of sex workers and prevention of trafficking, which is a huge problem, sex workers admit. But it created a misconception that all sex workers are trafficked and need to be rescued, says Meena Seshu. She's a longtime sex worker rights activist.
For years and years and years, adult women in sex work have never been treated as adults. Almost as if they did not have the ability to consent about their own work, about their lives.
Seshu says when police raid brothels, sex workers, including adults, are often sent to rescue homes where they are kept for months. Their children are left to fend for themselves. But traffickers are rarely punished, she says. If you want to really help sex workers, ask them what they want, Seshu says.
Create trust. I have told this to anti-traffickers for years. Don't swoop in and swoop out.
Some anti-trafficking organizations are criticizing the Supreme Court order, calling it short-sighted. One prominent activist said it could lead to criminals getting away under the pretext of voluntary work. Some groups want to abolish sex work altogether because they consider it inevitably exploitative. But Sunita, the sex worker in Hyderabad, says there's nothing wrong with her work. I'm doing this to support my children, she says. It's like any other job. Her friend V. Sai Lakshmi tells me sex work helped pay for her sister's wedding and for her father's funeral. If we are doing this willingly, how can it be wrong? She asks. The recent Supreme Court order strengthens her argument. But activist Meena Seshu says there will be pushback, and anti-trafficking groups have the ear of the government and society.
Society's morality about sex, per se, colors everything to do with sexual service providers.
Unless social attitudes change, sex workers will have to continue to fight for their rights. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Hyderabad, India.
The King of Belgium is visiting the Democratic Republic of Congo this week, putting a spotlight on their brutal colonial relationship. We'll unpack that history just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It is a historic week of reckoning in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Belgium's King Philippe paid a visit to the former Belgian colony in Central Africa.
Ce régime était celui d'une relation inégale.
This regime was that of an unequal relationship, King Philippe said on Wednesday. He called it unjustifiable and said it was marked by paternalism and racism. The Belgian rule over the Congo was brutal. By some estimates, up to 10 million people were killed by atrocities, famine, or died from introduced diseases from 1885 to 1908, when the territory was personally owned by Belgian King Leopold II. But from the Western perspective, the Congo was a place to exploit.
Here lived Africa's peoples, buried in their jungle, too backward to realize the inheritance it offered, the untapped resources of their vast continent.
That's a clip from the 1950 film Congo Harvest. There is a lot to understand about Belgium's colonial rule in Central Africa and how the modern Democratic Republic of the Congo reconciles the past and sees its future. We're turning to Charles Chimanga Kashama to learn more. Charles is an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Nevada, Reno. Charles, what is the significance of this visit by King Philippe of Belgium for Congolese people?
Thank you, Marco. For the Congolese people, this is historical because the last visit from a Belgian king, it was a long time ago, between the two countries, this is really a big event, and especially in the context of what's going on right now.
How is Belgium's colonial rule remembered today in Congo?
So in Congo, we have a generation of people who have not known about Belgian colonialism. But for most Congolese, they remember the brutality of the Congo Free State, which was led by King Leopold II. And they expect King Philippe to apologize for the past, for the brutality of that regime, for the exploitation of the Congo. But since his visit, King Philippe, yesterday, he said once again that he was presenting his deepest regret to the Congolese people. So far, he has not apologized.
So, as you said, King Philippe this week in Congo said he deeply regretted what happened, but has not apologized. I mean, that's the monarchy, and Congolese are still waiting. But has Belgium's government done enough to acknowledge that history?
Following the death of George Floyd here in the U.S. in 2020, there is ongoing debate in Belgium. So the Congolese diaspora living in Belgium launched a debate. They began asking Congolese government to revisit Belgian colonialism in the Congo. So as we speak, there is a commission, a special commission, working with a number of experts trying to get a good understanding of what happened in the Congo at the time of Belgian colonialism. So I'm one of the experts working with them, giving them my feedback. So as we speak, there is this ongoing debate.
So, Charles, you've recently joined a special Belgian parliamentary commission working to recognize Belgium's colonial past in the Congo. What are your hopes for this commission?
My hope is that this is not just something that is used to kick the can down the road. My hope is that we can, after the work is done, recommendations made by experts would be followed by legislations and new ways of doing business between the two countries. That's my hope. And I have to emphasize the word hope.
So how do you see Belgium and Congo moving forward from here?
Here is my expectation. I hope to see some changes. I want the paradigm to shift. You know, the Congo is one of the places with so many raw materials. Most of the tools that we use today are from the Congo. Cobalt, which is used to make batteries for electric cars. Coltan, which is used to be making cell phones, laptop, and so on, are from the Congo. Going back to even King Leopold II, the Congo has been seen mostly as the place you can go, dig, get raw material, and use them to make many of the manufactured goods that we are using in the Western world.
Well, we heard that clip from that Congo Harvest earlier.
Yes. So the Congolese president says this, If you want to go to the Congo to do business, we want a kind of a win-win partnership. He used the French word, partenariat gagnant-gagnant, a win-win partnership, which means we don't want you just to come and dig, get the raw material, but we also want you to help Congolese government build some plants in the Congo so that this can also create jobs and help Congolese people to continue moving forward.
What do you think it will really take for Belgium and the Democratic Republic of Congo to work together as equals? Because Belgium has not left the Congolese on equal footing.
Yes. So that's why I think that the pressure coming from the ground, the pressure coming from the diaspora, the pressure coming from the academic world, I hope that this maybe lead Belgium to be making some needed adjustment. I'm not foolish. I understand that relationships between states are based on interest. And as we speak, Belgium is more powerful than the Congo. So it's up to the Congolese to work hard to become really equal partners with Belgium.
Charles Chimanga Kashama is an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Nevada, Reno. Charles, thank you very much for speaking with us and helping us understand the history of the DRC. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity to chat with you.
One particular moment during King Philippe's visit this week has gotten a lot of attention. Belgium's king returned a traditional mask of the Suku people to Congo's National Museum.
The Kakungu mask means a lot to the Congolese.
That's Eric Kuikende Bonshona, a researcher at Congo's National Museum in Kinshasa, the capital of the DRC.
This mask shows that although colonization destroyed or cut the Congolese off from their history, we still have the culture alive.
He says the mask that was returned plays an important role in an initiation ceremony, which includes circumcision for boys as young as 10 years old.
The status of manhood, it is not given like a present. You have to deserve it, you have to fight for it. And the Kakungu mask is used during this initiation.
The mask's black paint represents life's adversities. The white represents joys in life. Adorning leopard skin symbolizes courage, and grasses along its sides show humanity's connection with nature. Eric Kuikende Bonshona says the return of a mask is not just about repatriating material objects. It's about restoring Congo's heritage.
Because when the objects were taken, the people were also cut off from their cultures, cut off from their history. So we are claiming both.
He says to return more items to the Congo will require collaboration.
Otherwise, they will only hand over objects that were illegally acquired. So what about the object that's somehow legally acquired?
Legally acquired, like the mask given to the country's National Museum this week. That mask was legally acquired by the museum in Belgium, and so technically it is now on indefinite loan back to Congo, a subtle but important distinction. Kuikende Bonshona is optimistic that more objects will be sent from Belgium to the DRC.
I do believe that this will be possible only through dialogue and collaboration.
Belgium's parliament is taking a step to make that happen. Lawmakers are soon considering a commission of Congolese and Belgian experts to decide on individual requests for specific items to be returned to Congo. You're listening to The World. If you want to be a saint, you better have lived an extraordinary life. Still, under Pope Francis, it's much easier to get into heaven's exclusive club.
You will hear sometimes that this is diluting how special and esteemed canonization is and should be.
Plus, Biden's gambit to play nice with China to bring in more clean energy. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Freedom of religion is enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Advocating for religious freedom abroad, that is a hallmark of U.S. foreign policy. Earlier this month, the U.S. government rolled out a massive report that examined religious freedom across some 200 countries.
The report gives voice to countless individuals around the world who have been killed, beaten, threatened, harassed, or jailed.
That's from a State Department briefing by the U.S. Ambassador at Large from the Office of Religious Freedom, Rashad Hussein. Ambassador Hussein joins us now from Washington. Ambassador, this new report is more than 2,000 pages long, not exactly light reading. Can you give us the overview?
As you said, religious freedom is a fundamental human right that goes to who we are. The report that we issued last week is really critical to cast light on oppression of people around the world. We believe that it's unacceptable for people to suffer based on their beliefs without us saying anything. And silence can actually embolden those that are engaged in oppression. And so we have to do everything that we can to expose it. And our report goes through, as you mentioned, a number of countries in which we're concerned about the religious freedom conditions. China is at the forefront of that. It's amongst the worst abusers of religious freedom in the world.
Well, let's take a few examples and what role the U.S. might play. I mean, you mentioned China. The report looks hard at China and specifically the abuses against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. What kind of leverage does the U.S. have actually over China's abuses against Uyghur Muslims?
Well, there's a number of steps that we've taken. We've designated China as a country of particular concern since 1999. We've formally determined that China's treatment of the Uyghurs constitutes a genocide and crimes against humanity. Congress earlier this year passed the Uyghur Forced Labor Act, which President Biden signed into law, which puts restrictions on importation of products that are produced as a result of forced labor. You might recall that earlier this year, we also made the decision not to have any diplomatic representation at the Olympics. We've instituted a series of financial sanctions as well and visa restrictions on those that are responsible for some of the crimes that we're speaking about.
Ambassador, let's talk about countries that are considered friendly to the U.S., which the U.S. has decent relations with. The case of India, a key U.S. partner in Asia. There are concerns about Hindu nationalism with India's politicians, main party, the BJP, ignoring, even supporting religious attacks on Muslims. So what's going on in India?
Well, we're following really closely the situation in India. As Secretary Blinken said last week, we have seen rising attacks on people in places of worship. And he had previously noted that we regularly engage with the Indian government, with our Indian partners, and we're monitoring the recent concerning developments there, including human rights abuses by government, police, and some prison officers as well. And as I mentioned last week, we're concerned about targeted attacks against religious communities in India, not just the Muslim community, but Christian community as well, the Sikh community, the Hindu Dalits, and indigenous communities.
I mean, India is a friend of the U.S. What can the U.S. actually do about such abuses in India?
We speak to them very directly about the concerns that we have with regard to attacks on the various religious communities that I mentioned. There's been calls to genocide in the country. It's important that governments around the world not only eliminate any discriminatory laws or policies on the books, but that they hold those who would restrict religious freedom or call for a genocide, as we've seen in India by some groups. We would urge governments to hold those individuals accountable. We believe that protecting religious freedom is something that goes to the heart of who we are as Americans. We are a country of immigrants as well. And so we have people that come to the United States from all over the world. And I get asked this question sometimes along the lines of, well, who are you to shine a light on what's going on in other places around the world? And the answer to that is in part that we are a country of people from all over the world. And oftentimes they come to the United States and demand that we hold their home countries accountable. Mm. So in a sense, we are made up of the rest of the world. And in a sense, they are the ones that are demanding that our elected representatives and those in government do everything that we can to promote our values, including religious freedom, all over the world.
Another U.S. ally, a troubling ally, Saudi Arabia, has a dismal track record of persecuting its Shia Muslim minority. If President Biden were to go to Riyadh, what would he be able to say about the arbitrary arrests and detentions?
Well, Saudi Arabia remains a country of particular concern with regard to religious freedom. It's been on our list of countries of particular concern since 2004. And yet, as you noted, they continue to target the Shia population. But beyond that, they also continue to criminalize blasphemy and apostasy. We've seen discrimination against the Shia population in the justice system and education and employment. And we speak very directly to the Saudi government about some of the concerns that we have there, including individual cases where individuals have been arrested and even imprisoned. And in some cases, individuals have even been executed. We believe that the government is taking some incremental steps to improve tolerance. I was recently in Riyadh, where for the first time ever, they hosted leaders from the Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, Sikh, and other communities at a major interfaith conference where these leaders had major prominent speaking roles. So they are taking some steps, but much more needs to be done, and we continue to be in dialogue.
Is the U.S. a little restrained right now from what it can say to Saudi Arabia, especially as there seems to be a willingness to court Saudi during this oil crisis?
Well, we don't see working with countries on a whole range of issues and talking to them about human rights and religious freedom as mutually exclusive. It's part of our relationship. It's a sign of a strong relationship to be honest and direct with our friends on a whole range of issues. So we're able to do both. We're able to engage on the range of issues in our bilateral relationship that includes human rights and advocating for international religious freedom.
I got to say, Ambassador, I hear the enthusiasm for your job just in your voice. What do you like most about your work?
Well, it is an honor, really, and a deep sense of obligation that comes with waking up every day and being able to go to work with a phenomenal team on helping people everywhere. And, you know, people ask about the metrics. And for me, the metric is any person we can help is worth it. Even one person that we can save. We aim to do much more than that. But it really is an honor, and it comes with a deep sense of obligation.
Rashad Hussain is the U.S. Ambassador at Large from the Office of Religious Freedom. He was speaking with us about a new report detailing the state of religious freedom around the globe. Ambassador, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Last month, Pope Francis announced the canonization of 10 new saints. It has become an annual routine for Francis. He's already created the most new saints of any pope in history. But with more than 10,000 saints already recognized, why is the Catholic Church making so many new ones? From Padua, Italy, John Last reports.
It's May 15th in St. Peter's Square in Rome, and Pope Francis is announcing the canonization of not one, not two, but 10 new saints, among them a French hermit, an Italian nun, and an 18th century martyr from India.
Justino Maria Rosolil, Carolin de Foucault.
These are just the latest to join the ranks of the elect, which are gaining new members at unprecedented speed.
Now you're getting hundreds. You know, John Paul II had 482. Pope Francis has had 909.
Michael Canaris is a professor of ecclesiology at Loyola University, Chicago. He says until the latter half of the 20th century, it was typical for a pope to recognize just a handful of new saints during their time in office. Not anymore. Within 2 months of his election, Pope Francis canonized 800 saints simultaneously. In one swoop, he canonized nearly twice as many people as Pope John Paul II, who's now a saint too, by the way. In his own time, John Paul II canonized as many saints as every pope in the last 400 years combined. These days, there are so many new saints that some are even wondering whether there's too many.
Sure, you will hear the counter opinion sometimes that this is diluting how special and esteemed canonization is and should be. I think it is the idea that the church is much broader.
Canaris says the rise in canonizations can be explained as part of a shift underway in the church since the 60s to broaden the definition of holiness and include more lay people, more women, and more non-Europeans among the saints.
Pope Francis and John Paul II, they shared this idea of a simple sanctity, a universal sanctity.
Valentina Ciciliot is a researcher in the humanities at the Ca' Foscari University of Venice and an expert on canonization since John Paul II.
Pope Francis spoke about this idea that a saint could be also your neighbor.
Of course, becoming a saint is still not easy, but it has recently gotten easier. Under John Paul II, the Church reformed the process for recognizing saints. The number of miracles needed dropped from 4 to 2. The wait for canonization was cut down too, from 50 years after death to just 5.
That was revolutionary because basically he could canonize people that were almost contemporary, like, for example, Mother Teresa of Calcutta.
Those changes opened the floodgates for hundreds of canonizations. Good news for underrepresented Catholic communities. But experts say it's not just diversifying the highest ranks of heaven that motivates the push for more saints.
Not only is religion a market where different religions compete, but people are rational actors and they choose religions. They move in and out.
Rachel McCleary is an economist at Harvard University who studies canonizations. She says the key to understanding the flood of new saints is competition.
This year, the largest Catholic country in the world, Brazil, will become majority Protestant. This is a huge problem for the Catholic Church.
McCleary says the latest surge in saints fits a pattern for the church. From 16th century Germany to modern day Guatemala, saints tend to multiply in places where Protestantism or secularism is on the rise. The effect, she says, is to gin up the faithful and give local Catholics a home team to root for.
I know, I'm not really sure about that theory.
Ciciliot disagrees. She says canonizations are more often used to advance a pope's particular political vision. She points to prominent anti-communists who were made saints under John Paul II, for example. There's also his canonization of Gianna Beretta Mola, an Italian woman who died rather than lose her child in childbirth, a papal rebuke, she argues, to advocates for abortion access in Italy.
He basically stressed with a very powerful figure his commitment to the defense of life.
Francis's own selections can tell us plenty about his politics. His 900 new saints include indigenous martyrs, Latin American mystics, and those who worked with the poor, married couples, teenagers, and otherwise ordinary people. And he's not done yet. Before the end of this year, he'll canonize two more saints, an Argentinian pharmacist and an Italian bishop known for his work with migrants. It's all just more proof that in the Catholic Church, there are many paths to sainthood, and there are many reasons why a pope might want to put you there. For The World, I'm John Last in Padua, Italy.
When it comes to solar panels, it's been a multi-year-long battle between Washington and Beijing. The Obama administration first imposed tariffs on solar panel exports from China a decade ago. The Trump administration heaped on more import duties. Now the Biden White House is hitting pause on the solar wars. Here to tell us why is David Sandilow from the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. David, why is Biden doing this? What's the administration's short-term goal?
President's doing this to prevent the collapse of the U.S. solar industry. Before Monday, a single case filed with the U.S. Department of Commerce by a very small California solar manufacturer threatened to almost shut down the U.S. solar industry for the next year. And that's because the case created a risk of retroactive tariffs being applied to almost all solar modules imported into the U.S. And that led to a situation in which solar manufacturers around the world were simply unwilling to sell to purchasers here, and projects were being canceled. Hundreds of projects were being canceled because of this one case that was filed.
Yeah, so that small bit of litigation from California, what was the complaint in the case, and why is it relevant here?
The company, his name is Oxen, complained that Chinese manufacturers were circumventing U.S. tariffs by offshoring their production to four Southeast Asian countries, and that under the statute that was illegal, and that additional tariffs should be applied.
Right. So back to my earlier question, why is the Biden White House hitting pause on these tariffs on Chinese solar panels?
In particular, threats to the president's climate goals. There was a significant risk of the application of these retroactive tariffs, and that was freezing the industry, creating some big risks. I mean, the three that I suspect were at the top of the mind were first threats to electric reliability. There are a lot of places in the country that were relying upon new solar projects for electricity. A second, job losses. I saw some estimates of about 100,000 job loss potential as a result of this. And then more pollution, in particular, the heat-trapping gases responsible for global warming and real challenge in meeting the president's climate goals as a result of this.
Is the Biden administration between a rock and a hard place here, basically needing more solar panels, but also wanting China to play by the rules? Is that how you see it?
The Biden administration is very keen to help promote solar manufacturing. And in fact, the president took some action to do that with a statute called the Defense Production Act, which he invoked on Monday to help spur the development of the domestic industry. Mm. And then at the same time, as you point to, there are enormous tensions in the relationship with China right now. But the Biden administration has been focused on this in at least one important respect. In December, the president signed legislation called the Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act. And the idea of that statute creates a presumption that any products that come from the province of Xinjiang in China, there's a presumption that those products have been made with forced labor. And a number of solar products come from that region. And so this is going to have impacts on the solar supply chain.
This move by the White House feels very much like it's following the tariffs on Chinese goods story. Perhaps there could be a dividend for the climate. What do you find the most interesting part of this whole thing, David? What are you keeping an eye on?
You know, there's nothing easy about the clean energy transition. I think we are at the early stages right now of a clean energy transition that's going to take place over the next several decades, where we're going to be moving towards much more use of clean energy products like, you know, like solar power in this case, but lots of other products too, like wind power and electric vehicles. But that transition raises lots of challenging issues. And this is just one example of that, where, you know, geopolitics in some ways gets in, global supply chains are implicated. Ultimately, what we need is a sustained commitment. You know, governments around the world are deeply committed to solar power. The Chinese government is deeply committed. European government is deeply committed. Last year in China, at least twice as much solar power was deployed as in the United States. And there's about three times as much solar power on the ground in China as in the United States. So if we're going to really win in the battle for this industry in the future, we need to have demonstrated commitment to it. And even though there's, you know, strong commitment to clean energy transition in some places, the path can be very, very complicated.
Mm. David Sandelo is the inaugural fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, where he founded and directs the center's U.S.-China program. David, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Marco.
Bogota, Colombia inaugurated an all-women's orchestra this year, an effort to close a gender gap in the country's classical music scene. The orchestra allows young women musicians to develop their talent after graduating from conservatories. Check out that story and others from Latin America on our website, theworld.org. There is no pause in the brutal fighting that has gripped the eastern Donbas region of Ukraine. Ukrainian commanders say their troops are battling for control of every house and every street in the eastern city of Severodonetsk. Accurate casualty figures are hard to come by, but Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says almost 300 Russian soldiers are being killed every day.
І все одно настане день, коли кількість втрат навіть для Росії перетне межу.
In a video shared on social media, a defiant Zelensky told Ukrainians, "The day will come for Russia when the number of losses will go beyond the permissible limit, even for them." Reporter Volodymyr Solohub joins us now from the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. Volodymyr, what's the latest you're hearing from this key city of Severodonetsk?
Marco, the situation in this eastern Ukrainian city is very tense. The Russians advanced on this city several weeks ago, but Ukrainian army has been holding ground. And I spoke to the governor, Marco, of that region earlier today, and he told me that there are at least 15,000 civilians still trapped in the city, and that humanitarian situation is very dire. They have not had access to running water, gas, or electricity for weeks now, and there is no cell phone or internet connection at all. So the loved ones of those trapped in the city have no idea of what's happening with their family members.
That's absolutely miserable. So what does this mean for those citizens' ability to leave Severodonetsk?
The governor, Marco, told me that they've halted all evacuations from Severodonetsk. It's physically impossible to evacuate anyone because the main road that connects Severodonetsk to the key city of Bakhmut, even though it's still under Ukrainian control, but Russians are heavily shelling this main road in an effort to gain control over it.
So as I said, Volodymyr, you're in Kharkiv. You're venturing into some of the cities that were recently under Russian occupation. What have you been finding?
The grim traces of war, Marco. Kharkiv region borders with Russia, and we're seeing more and more evidence that a lot of civilians were forcefully deported to Russia from the occupied villages when Russian army was having control over these areas. And some of those people were put into the so-called screening or filtration camps on the Russian side of the border. And some of them were shipped to faraway places that are closer to Alaska than to Ukraine. And we recently spoke to one of such person. Her name is Natalia. She said that she was taken into Russia against her will. She somehow managed to flee one of those filtration camps and is now making her way via Latvia, Poland, and back into Kharkiv.
Wow, that's extraordinary. So President Volodymyr Zelensky says the battle to defend the Donbas region will decide the fate of the war. And yet some of those Ukrainians who've been fighting there, they're not professional soldiers. They're volunteers with like real day jobs. You spoke with one volunteer named Hanadi. He fought in eastern Ukraine in 2014, recently deployed there again. What's his background?
He is in his mid-30s. and works as an IT specialist in the telecom company. He jokes that he uses his daytime job skills now to set up Starlink's terminals that Elon Musk has provided to Ukraine. As you know, a lot of these towns and villages that saw heavy fighting have no internet connection or coverage whatsoever. So Starlink is the only way to get in touch with the outside world, Marco.
So Hennadi has also been on the front lines very close to Russian troops. He told you his unit used to be on the offensive, but more recently it's been fighting defensively. Here's how he described it to you.
It's very intense, under heavy fire, and basically you just need to survive there and wait for the infantry attack. If the infantry attack comes, you fight back or you tell the coordinates to artillery or you launch drone. So basically you just have to survive and hold your positions.
Survive and hold your positions. Volodymyr, is that what most Ukrainian troops have basically been doing in the Donbas, just surviving?
Not exactly, Marco. You have to keep in mind that Hennadi is part of the volunteer battalion. So he's not a professional soldier. He's not a member of a regular army. And definitely his situation is very different from that of the professional army.
So Hennadi has a wife and three young kids. His family has fled Ukraine. They're now in Michigan. I know he's desperate to see them again. Here's what he told you when you asked him why he was putting his life on the line.
We have no choice. Like, it's easier, you know, to make decisions when there is really no choice. Either we want to survive as a society, as a country, as a community, and we fight, or, I don't know, we move to another country, to another planet. It's like, you know, a gangster or burglar storms into your house, you have to defend.
Yeah, and being constantly on the defensive, it's hard. But Hennadi's unit has actually liberated some towns under Russian occupation, right?
Yes, that's correct. He has been fighting here in the Kharkiv region since mid-April. And in the past, actually, several weeks, they had quite good advances closer to Ukrainian-Russian border. He said that they were trying to push Russians all the way to the border. But unfortunately, that stopped approximately a week ago when Russians started to fight back much more aggressively.
So Hennadi, I understand, has not seen his family for more than 100 days. Here's what he told you, Volodymyr, about how they actually stay in touch.
We communicate daily with kids and with my wife, and we do yoga together almost every day. And of course, well, we miss each other, that's obvious.
And Hennadi may actually get to see his family in Michigan in a few months because of a provision written into law in Ukraine. Tell us about that.
Yes, when the war broke out, Marco, the president of Ukraine signed a decree prohibiting men of age between 18 and 65 to leave the country. There are certain exceptions, and one of such exceptions will apply to Hennadi, that men that have three or more underage kids are able to travel abroad, and that's what Hennadi hopes to use when traveling to see his family sometime soon.
I mean, the clips we've heard of Hennadi, I mean, it suggests he's got energy. And yet we hear from President Zelensky that 60 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying in combat every day, with about 500 more wounded. So how long can Ukrainian soldiers keep up the morale that you hear in Hennadi's voice?
Yes, it's remarkable when you talk to Ukrainian soldiers, what keeps them going. And Marco, all of the soldiers that I've been talking to in the past 3.5 months of this war, they say pretty much the same thing, that this is our land and we have no other option than to defend it and fight it till the last drop of blood, and then adding Russian soldiers' last drop of blood. So, Marco, the morale is still pretty high, and the overwhelming support that Ukraine receives from the countries around the world definitely adds up to their higher morale.
We will leave it there. Reporter Volodymyr Solohub in the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. He's been speaking with volunteer soldiers there who are fighting with the Ukrainian military. Thank you very much, Volodymyr. Stay safe.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nana Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. Before we go, the podcast you just listened to is available free and on demand because listeners like you support our work. If you value our independent, fact-based journalism, please consider making a contribution before our fundraiser ends on June 30th. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate, or you can follow the link in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.